Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert is assistant editor Helen Crane. And coming up, the kids are all right. Forget crypto. Young investors reckon a solid stocks and shares ISA is the best route to becoming a millionaire. Are they right? Also today, the end for rock-bottom home loans as 500 mortgages are pulled from sale in the last month. Santander nudges up the rate on its 123 current account. So is it back to the glory days of 3%? What can the government do to help drivers as petrol and diesel prices continue to soar? And we asked it last week, we're going to ask it again because A, it's important, and B, Simon wants me to, because he himself is now facing this dilemma, to fix or not to fix your energy bills. That is the question again. So what will Simon do? He's got the calculator out. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, while crypto and meme stocks may have been making all the headlines during the pandemic, it's the trusty stocks and shares ISA that youngsters really think is their route to financial success. That's according to some new research of young investors who have stocks and shares ISAs. But be that as it may, aren't they a little deluded? With a lot more of under 25s thinking they can become millionaires with an ISA compared to older investors? Or is it just because they have more time to invest? Or is it something else? Simon! Granted, a relatively small study of, as I said, ISA investors, I should point out. What does it really tell us, though, and young people's attitudes to investing? Can we broaden this out into something a little bit wider?
Yes. So, in this poll of 1,000 ISA investors by Free Trade and Investing Reviews, 14% of them, under 25, expect to build a tax-free pot of £1 million by retirement. So that's a tax ISA, £1 million in their ISA. Now, that's quite impressive because they might also be investing in a pension as well. So they might end up with even more investments. But let's just talk about the ISA here. Now, 14% is obviously not a majority. Most of them are not confident of building up £1 million. Okay, so on average, investors anticipated building up a pot of £218,000. It's unlikely that they came up with such a specific number en masse. I think there may be some averaging across different numbers that people gave here. And 41% of them don't think they'll pass the £100,000 mark, though. So there's a big gap there, right? But I guess really the question that you have to start with is, why would you want £1 million in your ISA anyway? What's the point? Who wants to be a millionaire? Well, I think firstly, it's still a nice round number, isn't it? It's a really great number to aim for. Although becoming a millionaire now, yeah, is certainly a very different gig to becoming a millionaire when I was a kid and I dreamed of becoming a millionaire.
Why?
Your £1 million will not buy you anywhere near as much as it once would have done. I mean, the first problem is, if you're a millionaire, what's the first thing you think about doing? I'm going to get myself a swanky house. Well, as we talked about on the podcast last week, those swanky houses, they're going to eat up a lot of your £1 million. In fact, depending on where you live, they're going to eat up more than your £1 million. But still, it's a nice number to have. I think actually the interesting thing about that, if you can build up a nice pot of £1 million, is maybe it's separate to that whole dreams of millionaire lifestyle. It is the idea of financial independence. It's the idea that if I had £1 million, I would no more be beholden to the man. If I've got £1 million in my ISA, it means that I can live a financially independent lifestyle and I don't have to rely on having to work when I don't want to. Might still work, might still do a bit of stuff. And there's this whole financial independence, retire early, FIRE movement, which I think is really interesting. People who are on varying scales, saving or investing really hard now, perhaps foregoing lots of stuff in order to reach financial independence as early as possible, not waiting until their pension years. So if you've got £1 million in your ISA, the important thing is the money that you take out of that is tax-free. So essentially you can draw a tax-free income from it. And all of the gains that you make in there, the capital gains, are tax-free. That's the great thing about an ISA. Now, what could you get from your £1 million ISA? Well, you could get maybe 4% a year. That's considered a reasonably safe amount that you can withdraw from your investments and not run them down. And you don't want to run them. You, run them down because you want them to keep their value and maybe rise a bit with inflation. So 4% a year is considered that's the okay number. So that's £40,000, isn't it? Which is a nice sum of money, but it's not a huge sum of money in today's day and age, but it is tax-free. And to get £40,000 after tax, you need to earn probably about 60, maybe a bit more. So all of a sudden you're starting to talk about, you know, a pretty decent sum. You get £1 million in your ISA, you can sit back, relax, live your life of financial independence. So I think that's why people want to do it. And that's where the attraction comes from for a lot of people, is basically it gives them options. And also it's just a nice target to aim for, isn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having £1 million in an ISA, indeed anywhere. But is it realistic? Is it easy to do?
I don't think that getting to £1 million in your ISA is a particularly easy thing to do, to be entirely honest. I think that ultimately you...
What will these under 25-year-olds really have to sacrifice more than lattes and avocado, doubtless?
Well, they're going to have to sacrifice quite a bit. You're going to have to pay in quite a lot of money every month into your ISA, and you're going to have to commit to that. And that is money that's going to eat into what you are able to do with your life. And then you're also going to have to be lucky enough to benefit from a substantial amount of growth in your investments. And the problem is that you might pick funds or investment trusts or ETFs that do very well, or you might end up with ones that suffer or do well and then suffer. And the AIC, the Association of Investment Companies, had some figures out that we've used, and it's the trusts that have turned ISA investors into millionaires. So the most popular ones invested in that have turned them into ISA millionaires, right? Most popular trusts in ISA millionaires portfolios. So you've got something called HG Capital Trust. That's a private equity trust. That's pretty niche. So let's knock that one out for a moment. Let's go to the more mainstream ones. Scottish Mortgage, you know, super duper global investment trust, invests in disruptive companies, has done very, very well, backing the disruptive tech and other and tech influence companies, and has absolutely surged in value in recent years. It's also down about 30 to 40% since its peak at late last year. So, I mean, that just goes to show that if you were an ISA millionaire and you had a lot of your money in Scottish Mortgage, you would now have less of your money there. Now, the advice to investors in this kind of scenario is, if you still believe in your investment, sit tight, don't panic. Good companies will come good, and so on. But it does highlight the risk, and it's why you need a portfolio approach. Next on the list, Allianz Technology Trust. Again, that's pretty focused. That's a technology investment trust, so that you're not investing across a broad market. Pacific Horizon, that invests in the Asia Pacific. Polar Capital Technology, Aberdeen Standard Asia Focus. BlackRock Throgmorton, that invests in UK smaller companies. BlackRock smaller companies. Montanaro European smaller companies. Scottish Oriental smaller companies. But the thing is here, if you just had one or two of these, you are leaving yourself massively exposed to something going wrong. So you need to be across a diversified portfolio. And then once you go across a diversified portfolio, you're then going to start to see the magnificent returns from some of these things diluted. And maybe you should just go for a global tracker fund. And going back to that whole financial independence movement, there's a lot of people doing that who just invest in broad global tracker funds, and they don't try to beat the market, because if you try to beat the market, you run the risk of underperforming against the market. And instead, they're focusing more on the saving and investing really hard and saving money where they can, and less on the trying to pick the funds and investment trusts that are the winners. And actually, if any of our listeners are trying to achieve financial independence, then email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk or tweet us at This Is Money and tell us about what you're doing, because we'd love to tell your stories on the podcast.
I suppose, yeah, the good thing about an ISA, if you are trying to do the financial independence or FIRE method or whatever, is you can, well, access it earlier than a pension. So it's sort of a nice addition in that way. Helen, does this mean, going back to the start of this whole feature, that we slightly overblew crypto with young people? Actually, they are a little bit more sensible than we might have feared?
Possibly. So, as you said, this survey is of people who are saving into ISAs, so we can't quite quite rely on it to tell us what's going on with crypto. But it does say that, so I think it's 32% of people said they were investing in crypto, whereas just under half said they were investing in their ISA as a priority. So that means that they could be doing both. And that would be, you know, crypto, if you're doing it along with other methods of investing and saving, perhaps not too bad an idea. Don't necessarily need to be too worried about it. I would say the worry really is people, young people, putting all their money into crypto. It's difficult to tell, you know, it's still clearly extremely popular among young people, but as part of a wider portfolio of things they're investing in, and, you know, if they've also got a savings buffer, perhaps don't need to be too worried about it. Just be sensible, I think, is the advice.
Show of hands, who has a stocks and shares ISA? This really works for a podcast. That's two. Show of hands, who invests in crypto? That's a one. I don't have to say who. You can just guess. Unless Simon wants to admit to being one person that invests in crypto.
Yeah, I've got some crypto. I've got a small amount of Bitcoin and a smaller amount of Ethereum. But it's more a kind of, okay, well, just a tiny bit there in case it does really well. And actually, the money that's in the Bitcoin has done, by comparison with many other things, very well. I'm not some kind of crypto millionaire or anything. I'm not going to go buy my Lambo after we've done the podcast. But yeah, I've got a bit in there. But I think it is really important to have a portfolio approach. But just to put some perspective on the how much would you get if you invested really hard thing, if you invested £500 a month for 30 years and you managed to get a 7% average annual return, you'd get £610,000. So you wouldn't get to your million. I mean, so that shows how hard it is.
Yeah.
If you invested £800 over 30 years, £800 a month, every month for 30 years, and you've got an average annual return of 7%, you would get to £975,976.80. So near as damn it to your million pounds. £800 is a lot every month for 30 years. And 30 years is a long time to get there, isn't it? So, but you do have to remember, obviously, that, you know, for many people that would involve starting with a lower amount and then maybe being able to go over that 800 later on. But that then starts to mess with the kind of growth figures across the average. If you did it over 20 years, you would need to invest, let me just run the numbers for you quickly here, £2,000 every month for 20 years and get a 7% return to hit a million.
Which then goes back to the point of, why would you want to be an ISA millionaire? I mean, is this to forgo a pension or buying a house, eating?
Well, I guess the idea is that if you do it within an ISA, as you said, you can get the money. Yeah. So, for example, you build up your £1 million pot in your ISA, you hit that at 50, say. That means that you can live on that for the next 10 years. Until you're 60, and then you start taking your pension, and that supplements the income. Because you can't get a pension until the age of 55 at the moment. That's going to go up to 57, and it's probably going to be 60 before I'm 60, certainly. So I would be looking at trying to use money in my ISA to live on if I was going to be trying to do the whole retire early thing, rather than using my pension. But then what you can try to factor into that, of course, is the, can you do some work to supplement your income? And it's, you know, for a lot of people, I think, talking about the financial independence thing, it's not that they actually intend on not working at all. It's just that they'd like to be able to choose when, how, and what in terms of the work element. You know, maybe only a little bit for part of the year. maybe only a couple of days a week, maybe only stuff that they're really interested in. And actually, once you start bringing in a bit of money there, then you start lowering the amount of money you'd need in that pot in order to be able to live on it, don't you? So maybe you'd be happy with only £700,000 in your ISA, maybe. Only £700,000.
I'd take that. Don't make you, Helen. I'd take that as well. One final thing with this before we move on, because we've just discussed crypto. We haven't for a while. Is that it? We keep hearing regulations and crackdowns and, you know, very briefly, has it had its day, do you think?
No, I don't think it has had its day. I think that, as we've talked about before, the genie is out of the bottle. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with the crypto market, the crypto assets, the blockchain, the decentralized finance. Whether it's overhyped, whether it's overblown, I think some of it is. It's highly volatile. Bitcoin is currently trading about $39,000 as we record this. It got up to 44,000, having fallen below this level recently. I think it's in one of those periods of sort of within a range rather than doing the massive ups and the massive downs. I do think that with Bitcoin, there is an element now where it's so established that were it to fall substantially, i.e. $20,000, you'd then see a big wave of buying pressure from people. I don't think it's now in the scenario where you could find it going towards zero just from investor sentiment. There would have to be something that went seriously wrong in the crypto sphere. And there is the suggestion that more regulation could dent the price, but actually more regulation could support the price because it brings it within the financial system. The interesting stuff is the stuff that's going on with things like Ethereum, decentralized finance, Solana, all that kind of stuff. That's what lots of people are getting very interested in. And it starts getting very, very geeky. I think that, again, though, as I said, if you are going to invest in it, do your research and only make it a small part of your portfolio. And I think the other thing that is being talked about as well that highlights why crypto is not something that's just going to go away is the central banks talking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. The Bitcoin idea. I mean, this has been talked about this week. The Bank of England, doing its own digital currency. Now, the attraction of this for central bankers and for some countries is the ability to control money.
Exactly. Which doesn't that take away half of what makes it so appealing to certain people, right?
The selling point. Yeah, I mean, it's literally anti-decentralized. It's going back to centralization. And it's one of the most worrying things, okay? It's hugely worrying, this idea that we could take through the looking glass monetary policy on a step further so that instead of just giving people money when we have a crisis like coronavirus or something, where we did furlough in this country, but in the States, they just sent people checks to give them money to spend. The helicopter money thing, the idea that you could then give them money and then you could control how it's spent. Now, from a altruistic central banker point of view, this is great because it means you can make it so that it can only be spent to stimulate the economy. Perhaps it could be time limited. You give people the money, they've got a limited amount of time to spend it, and it can't go into investment accounts or being punted on GameStop shares or things like that. But from a moral and ethical perspective, that's very problematic. And it also leads into things where you have authoritarian states starting to control whether people can even live their lives, whether controlling their bank accounts, you know, controlling, can this person spend their money or can this person only spend their money in a certain way? Can we target this group of people? And I think it starts to become very problematic. I'd like to think that we would never put up with that kind of thing in this country. Or that we'd never put up, I think the people in America would never put up with this kind of thing, or people in the West would never put up with this kind of thing. But then I look at what Canada did with the trucker protests, and I think, whoa, hang on a minute, that is really disturbing, the freezing of the bank accounts and stuff. So I think it's really important that as we go into this brave new world of effectively being able to control people's money, that we're really, really cautious about how we do it. And I can understand why, you know, some of people in central banks and things are, you know, they're policy guys. They're coming up with ideas and they're putting out papers and things like that. But I do think we need to be really, really careful about it because that's the worrying edge of crypto.
Indeed, we do. Right, we're going to move on. but talking about having their day. Super cheap home loans. Bank and building societies pulled more than 500 mortgages from sale in the last month, the biggest monthly fall in availability since May 2020. So less mortgage choice, higher borrowing costs, record house prices, not to mention a cost of living crisis, wars, global pandemics. Are we reaching a crunch point in this somewhat surreal story that is the housing market over the last few years? Helen, what is going on?
Yeah, so as you say, it's been quite a wild ride in the mortgage market in the last couple of years. So if you look back to the summer of 2021, mortgages got ridiculously cheap, as low as about 0.83%, I think, in some cases. But now, thanks to inflation, thanks to the Bank of England increasing the base rate twice, so it's gone from 0.1% in December to 0.5% now. Mortgage rates are going up. So the average two-year fix today is 2.65%. That's according to MoneyFacts. That's the highest average they've recorded since November 2015. So that's an average. Lower rates are available. I think the best rate for someone with a 40% deposit now is about 1.6%. Still historically very low, but much higher than they were a year or so ago.
So what does it actually mean, financial terms, for home buyers at the minute?
So obviously the first thing to say is that for anyone who's already in a fixed mortgage deal, they're fine, they're protected from any rate rises until that deal comes to an end. For anyone looking for a new mortgage now, they'll basically be paying, in some cases, possibly about double the interest that they would have paid if they'd taken the same mortgage, say, 6 months ago. So one of the stories we've run on this, saying someone with a 40% deposit taking out a £150,000 mortgage, they'd now be paying about £70 more a month than they would if they'd taken out that same mortgage in October. So that's about £840 a year. Not an insignificant amount of money. And that's also on top of all the other household costs that are going up. I think that's the important thing. So, you know, bills going up, council tax is going to go up. And this is sadly just one more household expense that is on the rise.
In this instant or in this environment, is it a good idea to use a broker?
Yeah, definitely. I think they're not only going to have access to some deals that aren't out there on the open market, but they'll be able to look at your situation and sort of tell you what the best thing to do is. So particularly if you're looking at, you know, perhaps you've got a fixed deal ending, but it's not ending quite now. So it's in a few months and you're thinking, rates are getting quite high. Should I perhaps look to remortgage now instead? There might be an early repayment charge on that, but in some cases that could be worth it. That's exactly the sort of thing where a broker will be able to do the sums for you, tell you what might happen in the next few months and advise you on what the best course of action is. So yeah, definitely, definitely a good shout at the minute, I think.
Simon, your views?
My view, which is we talked about briefly last week, is that if you've got a mortgage that is coming up for renewal this year, if you're on a fixed rate that is rolling over this year, I would start looking into it now. Talk to a broker, start looking into it now, or at least trying to work out what your cost might be. You can lock into a mortgage, most mortgages 6 months in advance, might even be able to get a bit even further ahead of the curve than that. And it's well worth doing. One tip is the arrangement fee, add the arrangement fee to the loan. You can make a choice as whether you pay the arrangement fee or you add it to the loan. If you add it to the loan and then pay it off over 30 years, you're going to make the arrangement fee much more expensive. But if you add it to the loan and then just pay it off immediately when you take out the mortgage, then it doesn't make any difference. The difference it does make is that if you don't take out the mortgage, you haven't lost your arrangement fee. Or you, whereas if you've paid it up front and you don't take out the mortgage, you have. So you're kind of able to book into a mortgage now, lock in, you'll get it within the next 6 months or whatever. Do check the dates though. And actually check the dates on things like getting the valuation done and things like that, because I nearly got caught out by that many years ago, where I phoned up First Direct and went, yeah, that mortgage, I'll take that now. And they were like, well, why didn't you do this months ago when you phoned us up and booked the mortgage? I said, oh, well, you know, I wasn't actually going to save any money. I just needed in the future maybe. And they said, well, we can't actually do a valuation in time for you to get the valuation done and the mortgage done in time for the date. I think it was. It was either the valuation or they just were saying they couldn't even do the paperwork in time. I was like, eek. I did manage to get it sorted, but it took quite a lot of trying to convince them on the phone to get it sorted. So be wary of that kind of stuff. And also, if you just want to run the numbers, go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage finder, or just go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages, where you will find a link to it. That takes you to our partner service with the broker London & Country, who we've chosen because we've worked with them for many years. They're fee-free, so you don't pay anything up front. And you can use the calculator there to put in your house value, your mortgage size, your mortgage term, whether you want to fix, how long you want to fix for, and it will show you the best rates that you could potentially apply for. Now, you might not get all of these mortgages because it might be that perhaps they're not, that bank or building society isn't ideally suited to your exact circumstances, but it gives you an idea of what those numbers might be. And I think this is definitely the kind of time when people just need to run the numbers and know what they're getting into if potentially they are coming to the end of a fixed rate.
We're talking about running the numbers. Do you remember when Santander's 123 account was really rather good? Then over the years, it got progressively less good. Well, this week, it's announced it's upping the in-credit interest rate for the first time after a series of cuts over the years. So, Helen, is it back to its heyday?
It absolutely is not back to its heyday, but it's a slight improvement, which is quite a lot these days, you know, with a lot of accounts still paying 0.01%. So this is a 123 current account. Santander has cut the rate on that quite a few times over the last couple of years, but this is the first time in a while it's gone up. So customers with that account, their rate is going to go up from 0.3% to 0.5%. That's from the 28th of March. So that means someone who's got 20K in their current account could earn a huge £100 over the course of a year.
Yeah, that's not that enticing. I mean, comparing it to everything else that's out there, is it pretty good? What should we be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best of quite a bad bunch, you know, compared to other accounts. It's good. I will say, so it's a fee-paying account, so you do have to pay £4 a month. So that eats away at the interest as well. So that would be £48 a year. That's already wiping out about half of your £100 interest, and that's if you've got £20,000 in there. What it is interesting to look at is the other perks that come with the account. So you get £140 switching bonus if you're switching from a bank other than Santander. So that's, you know, not to be sniffed at. And it also has some pretty good cashback offers on bills. So up to 3% on some of your household bills. So that's, you know, that's fairly respectable.
I wonder, Simon, should they not just do like a 1 year introductory rather than this messing around with rates? You know, one day we're going to cut it and then we're going to raise it. And did they just, when they first introduce it, completely misread the market and how popular it would be? I just find it really annoying.
There was a stage when the 123 account was the thing to have. When it first came out, it was overwhelmingly popular and people were flocking to take them out. Did Santander misjudge that? I don't know whether they misjudged that. I think maybe it turned out to be even more successful than they hoped it would be.
Do they not give a toss because they know that they can just change the rate whenever they want to?
Well, they've had to lower various elements of it over the years, but we have been in a low interest rate environment. And I guess the thing is interest rates have gone up and Santander have raised the rate on the account. So in that sense, they're to be applauded because they could have just kept the rate the same, couldn't they? There does seem to be a little flurry of competition in the current account market at the moment. It ebbs and flows a bit. Long gone are the days of the bonanza of current account switching, when banks left, right and centre were falling over themselves to attract your business. But there is a bit of stuff going on. There's some good cash bungs being offered to people. First Direct, I think, will pay you £150 at the moment to join. Virgin Money has got a current account linked savings rate of 1% on balances up to £25,000, which is quite impressive, actually, when you compare it to the best easy access rates at about 0.7 to 0.8%. And I think it is still worth people looking for what they can get from their current account. Nationwide will pay you 2% interest up to £1,500 on its to Flex Direct customers. Lloyds pays 0.6% up to £4,000 and 1.4% on £4,000 to £5,000, that weird bracketing thing they do with its Club Lloyds account. And then there are the other ones that will, as I said, pay you to switch. NatWest, RBS, First Direct, £150. Santander, £140 cash back. Nationwide will give you £100 and £125 in Nationwide members for switching accounts if they don't already have a Nationwide current account. So it's worth doing. It's worth looking into this stuff. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/current and you'll find our five of the best current accounts. And then there's the whole, well, maybe you don't go for the bung. You go for a current account that you think will work best for you. For example, something like Starling has been very popular. Monzo has been very popular. It's worth looking into. And I think, you know, just because we're not quite in the flush of excitement of current account switching that we once were, doesn't mean that it's not still worth looking at whether you can get a better bank account elsewhere.
Indeed. All right then, if you drive, I was about to say you can get yourself, you know, maybe £150 if you obviously don't switch just for the sake of 150. Make sure that it's an account that you want and it's useful and it does all the things that...
Yeah, okay. So actually, to put this in perspective,
yeah,
the government's big idea to help people with their energy bills is to give them £200 off their energy bills this year, and then we're going to pay it back over the next 4 years.
Or £400 if you would listen to the newspapers at the moment suggesting we might have a £400 loan that we've got to pay back.
So the big idea is this £200, okay? Mm. Well, you could get £150 for switching your bank account.
Exactly.
I mean, that's, you know, so there you go. That puts it in a bit of perspective, doesn't it? I don't know. There was a supermarket that once said every little helps.
It also probably pay for you for, I don't know, a run around the town in your car, maybe extra. Because if you do drive, you cannot help but notice that petrol and diesel prices are pretty high right now. Filling up the average car is now £19 dearer than a year ago, and it's set to continue to go up. Sorry, but that's what they're saying. More than half of what we pay at the pumps, though, is tax. So can these be cut to ease the burden? Helen, do you drive?
No, I don't. I'm a classic London townie who doesn't have a car. I did briefly think about thinking about getting a car about a year or so ago. I was like, oh, you know, got a bit more money now, could be handy. But yeah, now with everything else going up, I'm like, actually, it's just the cost that I don't really need.
If you don't need a car, that's great. But how many people, Simon, rely on their cars for work? This isn't, you know, this is a real punch in the gut, isn't it?
It is. We can't all be London townies like Helen and make the wonderful money-saving decision a year ago to not buy a car. Bravo, by the way. You've saved yourself an absolute fortune by not doing that. Lots of people have to drive all the time. If you don't live in a major city, I mean, in all reality, if you don't live in London, you've probably got to drive quite a bit of the time. It's essential for families. It's essential for lots of people to get to work. And it's really expensive. It's one of those things that's also noticeably expensive. You really notice the fact that it's costing you £10 or more to fill up the tank. You really notice those prices going up on the sign outside the petrol station. The average for unleaded at the moment is 159.57p. And the average for diesel at the moment is 167.37p. Both of those are, and that's on the RAC's fuel watch, and both of those are likely to rise even further in the future. So basically, petrol was 35.26p a litre cheaper a year ago. Diesel was 37.84p less a year ago than now. And to put that into context, it's an extra £20 to fill the tank of the average family car. And if you're doing that 2, 3, 4 times a month, that's going to make quite a big difference. So is the government going to do anything to help?
What can they do?
Well, I mean, the answer to my first question is probably no. The answer to your question is they could cut the tax.
Okay.
So fuel duty is huge. Fuel duty is 57.95p of the cost of a litre of petrol or diesel.
What does that mean? What does it do? Why is it so high? Just give us a car driving fuel tax 101?
Well, in reality, it's even higher because you then pay VAT on top of it. You literally pay tax on tax, which has been a highly unpopular system for many years with people. Why is it so high? Because it can be high, because they can tax petrol that much, because driving is seen as bad and they want people to use public transport instead. And if you make driving cheap, people won't pay for public transport. My theory has always been that you should make public transport cheaper and then people would be less likely to drive. But this is not a strategy that Britain has adopted over recent years, much to the upset of many people who use the train to commute. So they make it awkward for people to drive and they make it expensive for people to drive. And it's also a big winner for the exchequer. It pulls in a lot of cash. So let's take a price of a litre of petrol at 155p, right? Of that, 51.7p is the cost of the petrol. 57.95p is the fuel duty. Listeners listening carefully will realise that the fuel duty is more than the cost of the petrol, even with oil prices running high. Biofuel content costs 25.2p. We have, because it's not all petrol nowadays. VAT is 11p. The retailer margin, the wicked petrol station, is 8.1p. And the delivery and oil company margin is 1.7p. Now, we regularly attack these wicked petrol stations and wicked oil companies and wicked fuel retailers for their actions. But you will have noted that they are taking much less money than the government, for example. Hence the calls on the government to do something. But fuel duty has been frozen for years. So actually, it's not risen in real terms. It's declined in real terms. It's declined in inflationary terms. And so they're going to be very reluctant to cut fuel duty. And it was also, it's a very anti-green measure, cutting fuel duty, for all of the reasons that we just discussed. Could you remove the VAT? Yeah, you could maybe remove the VAT. And actually, some countries have been looking at cutting fuel duty. But I don't think it's necessarily the kind of thing that is going to happen in this country. I think people are just going to have to cross their fingers that this rapid rise in petrol prices subsides.
All right, then. Finally, sticking with the petrol energy stuff theme, we asked it last week about fixing your bills. And Simon, you are now in this position where you are exploring or have been exploring whether that's what you should do. Some of the figures in your article are absolutely eye-watering. Tell us more.
Welcome to the mind-boggling world of my energy bills. Right, so, like many people in the country, I am staring down the barrel of my energy bills going up by a lot. In 2 days' time, my fixed rate with Octopus ends, at which point my energy bills will go up by about 50%. If I move on to the price cap. Unfortunately, I will have 2 weeks at that level, and then my energy bills will go up by another 54% when the price cap rises on the 1st of April. The combined effect of this is that my gas and electricity bills are going to double in less than a month. Not a prospect that I will admit I am much looking forward to, and a similar scenario to which many people in the country are facing. They might not have that rapid double whammy that I've got. This may have already happened to them. It may be about to happen to them in the future. If you're on a fixed rate deal that's going to see you through for at least the next year or longer that you took out some time ago when prices were lower, bravo to you is all I can say. You made a good choice, basically. Now, I wrote about this at the start of February and what I'd been offered by Octopus and what I might do. But a couple of things have changed since then. We now know what the new price cap is going to be. So for the average household, it's going to rise from £1,277 to £1,971. And that will run from the 1st of April to the end of September. That's the 54% rise I was talking about. But we also know that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has sent forecasts for what's going to happen to energy prices soaring even higher. Now, in early February, there was a widespread expectation that come the new price cap, so the next one from this on, in the start of October, energy prices were going to be higher, and so the price cap was going to go up more. But the thinking was maybe it might go up 20% or something like that. So much less than the jump we're seeing at the start of April. Unfortunately, the Russia-Ukraine crisis, energy sanctions, the threat of more sanctions, all this kind of stuff has thrown that into complete disarray. And now the expectation from analysts at Cornwall Insight, who got it pretty much right on the most recent energy price cap rise, is that we're going to see another 47% rise in the price cap from October. That would take it to £2,900 for the average household. It could go higher. Some are saying even higher, you know, but is it going to go lower? Might go a bit lower. Fingers crossed it will go lower. The other issue is, of course, is that that's for the average household, and we're not the average household. People spend different amounts on their energy. Those who listened last week will have heard me, Lee, and Georgie talking about the variance in our energy bills and mine and Lee's refusal to believe that Georgie was managing to spend so little on her electricity every month. And I had this conversation with friends as well the other day. And the range was between monthly bills of £50 and £250. And we were pretty surprised that people are either end of that range. I'm in the middle of that, really. Well, I'm not quite in the middle, but I'm on 150. It cost me about £150 a month on my fixed rate deal that's about to run out. So how do the numbers work? Well, in 2 days' time, that's going to rise to about £200 a month. But that's only going to last for those 2 weeks until the price cap kicks in. Then, if I stay on the default price cap tariff, they'll hit about £300 per month. So that's £3,600 per year. So what am I going to do? Right, I wrote this in my column in order to kind of talk people through this, because I have loads of people asking me about this at the moment. Now, Octopus wrote to me in late January, and it offered three options. There was the shift to its flexible Octopus energy price cap tariff. That's the £3,600 a year one. There was a 12-month fixed rate estimated at £4,970 a year. And there was a loyal Octopus 12-month fixed rate at about £4,400 a year. These are based on my estimated usage, right? The thing to remember is the fixes will last for a year, whereas going onto the price cap will only get me 6 months of protection, and then it's forecast to rise again. So let's say I pay £1,800 for that first six months. And then from October, it goes up by the expected 47%. I then pay £2,646 for the next 6 months. So that totals £4,446. All of a sudden, that 12-month fix that they offered me at £4,400 starts to look quite attractive, doesn't it? Because it's slightly less and it's guaranteed for the 12 months. Except when I was writing this on Wednesday, I clicked through on my email from Octopus. They sent me in late January. Now, they didn't say this offer was time limited, but I did think they were probably going to have put the prices up since then. They've gone up a lot, though. So the 12-month fixed rate is not now being offered to me. I'm being offered a 10-month fixed rate. So immediately, that's not right. As good.
Yeah.
And the standard one they're offering me is £487 a month. So that would be £5,844 a year.
Moly.
Or the loyal Octopus version,
yeah,
is £470 a month. So that's £5,640 a year.
Wow. Never so say loyalty doesn't pay, Simon.
Exactly. So my figure that I'm looking at here is £5,640 with this fix versus the £4,446 on the price cap. I'm going to go with the price cap. Okay, might get caught out. Maybe the price cap might double.
I was waiting for the big reveal there, Simon.
Yeah, well, I might get caught out. The price cap might double. But actually, it seems to me the only logical thing here to do is to go onto the price cap, take that risk, because that price cap figure is definitely lower than the fix they're offering me, to the tune of more than £1,000 a year. So substantially cheaper. Now, the old advice obviously would have been to switch, but energy switching is all but pointless for most people now. I did a comparison with our partner Compare the Market, and there's a 9 deals that I could switch to. Those range from Good Energy offering me £519 per month, which is £6,229 per year and a fix until September 2023, that's the cheapest one. So it's much more expensive than the Octopus one they're offering me. To Sainsbury's Energy's 1-year fix and reward tariff.
Right.
at £762.50 per month,
really,
or £9,150 a year. £9,150 a year. I hope that Sainsbury's
why
deal comes with a really big reward.
Why would you bother? Why?
I think they're pricing it because they just don't want the customers.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, don't bother.
Yeah, right? I think the unfortunate thing is that, like, you can price things because you don't want the customers, but there might be some people who take that out. I mean, I hope
maybe the rewards are, as you say, utterly, utterly extraordinary.
Maybe they give you a car.
Maybe.
Well, that's just going to get you bigger bills, as we discussed.
I'm trying to think if they made your shopping free for a year, whether that would even be 9,000.
No, I mean, it's really expensive. So look, the upshot of this is that for me, it's just a move on to the price cap. I think that for almost everybody, the scenario is going to be just move on to the price cap. All the research we've done, all the evidence we've got tells me that that's the best thing to do. But do your own research and check all the options your supplier can give you. Don't just do what they're offering you on the email. Phone them up. Tell them, you know, this is really expensive for me. I'm going to struggle with these bills. What can you offer me? What's the best you can offer me? See if there's anything that they can do to help you. A few cheeky low fixed rates might slip out as well, so keep your eyes open for those. There was a deal with Eon last week that was really, really, it seemed very good deal when people snapped it up and then it vanished quickly. And if you don't have a smart meter, and maybe even if you do have a smart meter, but make sure you take regular meter readings. So keep on top of your meter readings. Don't lumber yourself with a really big bill at higher energy costs when you've suddenly fallen behind on the meter readings. And definitely take a meter reading on the 31st of March before that price cap goes up. Take a photo of your meter, both your meters, your gas and your electricity, so you know what the figure was and you don't accidentally end up paying new, more expensive rates for energy that you actually used before that date.
Good advice. Helen, quick one before we go. We've got a, what are we calling it, spring statement, whatever, budget thing coming up. Are you expecting more help from the government? What do you make of the proposals of a even larger sort of loan scheme?
Yeah, I mean, £200 is a drop in the ocean compared to what most people's energy bills are going to be. And obviously, you're going to have to pay it back. I mean, £400, it kind of helps, but it's a loan, isn't it? It's not a gift. And who says that energy bills are going to go down by the time you have to pay it back? I mean, they might not. And then people are just lumped with that extra cost on their bills every month. I mean, we were talking about cutting VAT on fuel earlier. I mean, why not cut VAT on energy bills? That would be slightly helpful.
5%, though, isn't it? But I suppose
every little helps. I don't know. There's obviously huge pressure for the government to do something about this, but I'm not really holding out much hope.
All right. Well, that's it. We shall find out very soon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
And if you like a podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.